And we are doing a public hearing today on House Bill 5028, which is the Department of Higher Education Capital Construction Bill. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5028. And before we get in the swing of this, Mr. Bender, do you have any general announcements, or should we just jump right in?
I do have some announcements, and I also have a brief introduction to this bill. Just to let the committee know, some information about your schedule is you're now starting Department of Higher Education, and you're expected to be hearing this budget for the next 9 meetings. So this is the budget, of all the budgets that you hear in this particular subcommittee, this is the most complicated, and it takes the longest amount of time to go through. Today, there are generally 2 bills that carry the higher ed budget in them. One is the regular operating budget bill, and the other is a capital construction bill. The state constitution doesn't allow you to approve capital construction projects in the regular operating budget bill. So this is actually a separate bill for capital construction, which is House Bill 5028, the one that you are hearing today. Starting tomorrow and for the remainder of the 9 public hearings, you will be looking at the other bill, which is the operating budget bill. If I may, Madam Chair and members, just do a brief introduction of capital construction and higher education. This is the only one of the education budgets where you look at a capital construction bill, because it's the only area in higher education where the state is owning and constructing facilities. I've distributed to you a very brief capital construction funding overview that looks like this. And if I may just talk very briefly about how the state finances the facilities of higher ed, I think that would be very helpful as you hear this presentation and as you look at the budget before you today. But basically, there are a number of sources that the state uses to pay for higher education facilities. The first of those is actual general fund. And general fund is, when it's used for higher education, is typically not provided to completely pay for a project, but it is combined with Article 11G bonds in order to help finance projects. So a little bit of description is needed, I think, about what these Article 11G bonds are and how they work. The state constitution severely limits the amount of debt that the state can incur and restricts the debt into very defined categories. What Article 11G is it's an article of the state constitution that grants authority for the state to issue general obligation debt for the construction of facilities at higher ed and at community colleges. When an Article 11G bond, when the state issues an Article 11G bond, it becomes a general obligation, which means that it can be sold at favorable interest rates, and the state then pays the debt service of this bond during the term of the bond. So, for example, if it's a 30-year bond, for the next 30 years, the state pays the debt service from the state general fund. So clearly, these Article 11G bonds have an impact on the state budget because the state does pay the debt service. The article of the
Mr. Bender, may I ask a question? The 11G bonds, are they always for a defined 30-year term, or is it dependent on what it is that's being bonded?
It's dependent on what is being bonded, and they do not have to be issued for a 30-year term.
Thank you.
Many of them are, though. The constitution that authorizes the bonds also contains a requirement that the bonds be met on a on a dollar-for-dollar basis with general fund appropriation. So, for example, if there is a $40 million project, capital project, either a new facility or an addition to an existing facility or the repair of a capital facility, it could not be entirely financed by Article 11G bonds. There has to be a dollar-for-dollar match, so the most bonds that could be used for that project would be $20 million in bonds, matched by $20 million in general fund. And that would be actual general fund that would be paid that biennium for the $20 million. However, over the recent past, the state has shall we say, extended the definition of general fund by putting a number of fund sources into the general fund that could be used as an Article 11G match, as opposed to true or real general fund. The main item or revenue source that the state has been depositing into the general fund are the gifts that higher education campuses receive for capital construction projects. So if someone donates money for a particular project, what we've been doing recently is we've actually been putting that money legally into the general fund so that it can be used for match purposes. So this $40 million project that we were talking about can, and in fact, most recently, it's most likely if that $40 million project were to go, the way it has been going most recently is that there would be $20 million in Article 11G bonds matched not by $20 million in real general fund, but by $20 million in donations that the institution raises that are put in the general fund, become that match, and then there's $40 million to complete that project.
So at that point, then, the liability for the general fund would be on the payback side?
Yes. It would then be on the debt service, but not in the initial outlay. To give you some idea about these Article 11G bonds, there are about $123 million of them outstanding. And the debt service on these are, in the current budget period, or I'm sorry, in the upcoming 03-05 biennium, it will require about $25 million in general fund to pay the debt service on the bonds that have already been issued. About $22 million of this is in the higher ed budget, and the remaining $3.3 million is in the community college budget for the bonds that have been issued for community colleges. Let me just say, before going on to the next revenue source, that although Article 11G bonds may be issued for community colleges, in fact, they have not been since the 1970s. So all of this $3.3 million in debt service are for bonds that were issued, you know, a long time ago and are almost retired at this point. And I think the state has typically been doing this because community colleges have authority to get issue bonds or, to go to their voters for property mm-hmm. tax levies to pay off bonds for their facilities. Mm-hmm. And I do know, though, that, I'm sure you've been hearing from community colleges requests to issue bonds for their projects this biennium, and if you are, those bonds that they're talking about are Article 11G bonds. The next source of funding that has been used for for higher ed capital construction projects are lottery bonds. Lottery bonds are paid for from lottery receipts, and those were used for the first time last biennium. So this is a very new revenue source. There were a total of, 19 million dollars in lottery bonds. Did I get that right? Yeah, $19 million in lottery bonds that were approved last session. And now the debt service on those are being paid by the lottery, so that's also a state obligation. That will total $4.1 million this biennium. If you switch over, the next revenue source that is used to finance higher ed capital construction projects are another type of bonds authorized by the state constitution. These bonds are authorized by Article 11F1. 11F1 bonds are different than 11G bonds in that, first of all, they do not require any match at all. So they don't require a general fund match or any other type of gift match or anything. Secondly, the second difference is that they're only available for certain types of facilities. They're only available for facilities where there is the Constitution, constitutional language says that the facilities must be self-liquidated and self-supporting from revenues, gifts, grants, the Constitution doesn't go into that detail, but it does say that the facilities must be self-liquidating and self-supporting. What this has typically meant is Article 11F1 bonds are issued when there's a specific revenue source that's been identified or revenue stream that's been identified to pay the debt service on them. The debt service for Article 11F1 bonds does not come from the general fund, so we don't appropriate general fund. Rather, it's coming from university and institutional budgets, and there are several categories of projects that fall that are financed by Article 11 F1 bonds. For example, things such as housing and dining facilities would be financed by Article 11 F1 bonds, and then the debt service would be paid by dorm fees or by, food service fees. Other items that are financed by Article 11 F1 bonds might be parking facilities, whether they're in parking fees to pay the debt service, conference facilities, sports facilities, student unions. Student unions and student facilities have a specific source of revenue to repay them, which is the student building fee. Those monies are used to repay the debt service on those bonds. But also, Article 11 F1 bonds have been used in the past to finance what are essentially academic functions, academic facilities, where there isn't a specific revenue source available to, or an identified revenue source available to pay that debt service. And the institutions have been using their regular operating funds for their educational programs to pay for the debt service. So that's to say they would be using their tuition revenues. And technically not directly their state general fund, but as you'll see tomorrow when we start talking about the operating budget, at the institutional level, institutions combine their state general fund and tuition dollars as a practical matter in order to support their budgets. But for an accounting purposes, for these types of Article 11 F1 bonds, they do not use state general fund. Then finally, there are other revenues to support capital construction projects. These include gifts, grants, capital reserves, federal and local government revenues. I've mentioned some legislation there that affects capital construction next, but I'll get to that in just a second. But if you just look at the table here on the third page, these are the projects that are approved in the governor's budget, and you'll be hearing much more about this later. I don't want to take up much time to talk about these projects right now, but just to note, if you look at the 11G bonds and the general fund, you can see that there's only one project that uses general fund or 11G bonds, and that is to provide funding for academic modernization, capital repair, and deferred maintenance. This is a major concern at the university system. The facilities are very often not in a good state of repair, and if you visit campuses, you see that. It was estimated several years ago that it would take $400 million just to basically repair all the problems in the facilities that exist in higher ed. And each year, or each biennium, it would take between $50 and $80 million just to keep up with things that are going wrong, so to prevent things from being in an even worse situation, you would have to spend that amount of money. Again, this is a very serious problem, and the state has not had funds to allow higher ed to address this. In addition to these capital repair issues, there's a related but really separate issue of academic modernization, which is not to get the facilities back into more the state that they were when they were constructed. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about deferred maintenance. It's like getting them back in that state when they were new and there weren't problems with them. But academic modernization deals with the fact that, a lot of these facilities are 30, 40, 50 years old, and the way that services are provided has changed. So they need to be wired, for example, to provide internet access. And there are a lot of things that need to be done to bring them up to modern standards. And that would be outside this $400 million figure. It would be even beyond that. What this budget provides, if you look at that number 1A, you can see there's $55 million here for this academic modernization and capital repair. So basically, this is not really enough even to keep from falling farther behind. And very briefly, I think I'm talking longer than I told you.
So the $12.5 million general fund is matched for the 11G portion of the bonds?
Right. There's the dollar-for-dollar match.
Okay, and then where does the $20 million come from for the F bonds?
For the Article 11, there are also academic modernization issues and capital repair issues in the parts of the budget that aren't generally general fund supported. So these would be in, for example, the housing facilities. This would be in the student facilities. These would be a number of facilities where there would be defined revenue streams to help finance costs of capital repair and dealing with deferred maintenance there.
Okay, what constitutes other revenue?
Other revenues, I think I'm going to defer to the department when they make their presentation, but also other these are also supported by the operating budgets of the institutions. So, you know, if a roof goes, for example, on a campus and it needs to be repaired, they're going to have to go and they're going to have to repair it. And some of the other revenues that they may be using might just be their typical operating revenues that are available to them to meet their ongoing costs.
Is there any way for the committee to get some information presented that'll give us a bead on what the general fund is indebted for in the repayment of the existing bonds?
Yes.
I think that as we look, given the fiscal constraints that are so clear to us in the budget cycle that we're working in right now, if there is a way that we can kind of get a global look at what the general fund is going to be indebted for in 03 and 05, given the existing bonding load, and then what is being proposed, how much that indebts the general fund, it would be in 05, 07.
That's correct. The debt service on these Article 11G bonds, the $12.5 million, would start in 05, 07. Again, just to repeat a number for you, the debt service in 03, 05 for bonds, Article 11G bonds that have already been issued, total, the cost for that is $25.2 million.
There it is. Okay, so $25.2 million will have to be earmarked in 03-05 from general fund just to maintain the existing commitments.
Madam Chair, along those lines?
Clarification?
How long does that, I mean, these are different bonds spread out over various periods of time. What's it look like, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years out? Are these 30-year bonds, 25-year bonds, variations of that?
They are variations of bonds. I don't have with me a debt schedule, and I don't know if you've brought one or not, but if not, we can get that.
If it would be possible for the committee to get that, I think that that would be a conversation point as we go into work session on this.
I have another question.
Representative Smith?
Yes. On Article 11G, as in Article 11F, the limited value of is $1.94 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And 11G, we have $123 million. And then are we supposed to add the $450-some million of F1 bonds to, is that the same $1.94 billion that it caps?
No, there's actually, the Constitution would allow the state to have up to $1.94 million of each of those.
In each of those, okay.
Yes.
All right, because I noticed the number was the same and thought that odd.
They are the same, but they are, again, separate limitations. They just happen to be the same limitation for each type, both of the types of bonds.
Okay, and then they are asking, if I'm clear here, $500 million in G bonds to address their deferred maintenance situation. Is that correct?
Yes, let me just mention, go on to this legislation, this other legislation. This is not the bill that you have before you today, but these are things that are out there that you may be hearing about and that they're related to the capital construction issue. The first is, it would be SJR1 and Senate Bill 240, which are both in Ways and Means right now. What SJR1 does, or would do, is it would establish a new constitutional authority for bonds. So in addition to Article 11G and Article 11F1, there would be a new authority that would allow up to $500 million general obligation bonds to be issued to address the deferred maintenance and the academic modernization costs at OUS. These would be different from Article 11G bonds in that there would be no general fund match required, so they could just be issued without a general fund match, and that they would not be available to community colleges as Article 11G bonds are. If you approve this measure, voters would then decide its fate at the 2004 primary. And if the voters then agreed to approve it as well, Senate Bill 240 is the companion vehicle that actually issues bonds, as opposed to, you know, the SJR just authorizes or allows them to be issued. Senate Bill 240 would issue those.
Question.
Hold on, thank you, Representative Smith.
How are the payments made on those bonds?
Those payments would be made from the state general fund.
And then we just don't get the match, but we make the payments.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
And the duration of the bonds would be dependent on the projects that would be covered?
That would be the case.
And how much would the payments be on $500 million?
Well, that would be would all the $500 million be put out in one?
It wouldn't be put out in one, but
it wouldn't necessarily. It would still be the case that the legislature, well, first of all, in Senate Bill 240, if you pass 240, you would include in that how much of this would be issued in 0305 biennium. It would not have to be the full $500 million. It could be spread out. The way that this SJR1 is written is it has a 10-year period for which these bonds are authorized to be issued. So perhaps the proponents have in mind using the entire 10-year period. I don't know whether that's really their intent, but it would allow at least a 10-year period of time to issue up to $500 million in bonds. So there would be no requirement to issue $500 million all at once. And frankly, even if the voters approved it, there's no requirement to issue any of them. It's just an authorization to allow it. I mean, I'm sure if the voters approved it, you'd want to do something, but there's no requirement to do it.
Chair.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible, there's three areas I'm concerned about. First of all is, by raising this capital, what kind of an economic impact would that have in our state? In other words, what is the return on the investment? Second, if we could get some kind of a breakdown on the risk involved. As I look through the list, some of these appear to me to have a certain amount of risk, and how real that is. Maybe it's not a real risk at all. And thirdly, could we have some kind of a report on, and as we make these investments, is there also operating funds that will be needed to carry on the operation of the investment? I think I want to see the size of the whole mountain instead of just the construction part.
Good questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
As I read through this and go through my mind, it looks like what we're trying to do is leverage more borrowed money at this point. Senate Bill 437 allows, I mean, the way it's set, the way I understand it, is you limit the amount of money you're going to borrow based on the fact you have to match general fund now with your borrowing for the future. That puts an automatic tendency to slow things for you. Senate Bill 437 allows COPS to be used, which would mean you're borrowing money to match money. You're borrowing money to make the match to borrow money. Okay? That's basically what it does. Is that right, Steve?
Yes.
You're doing short-term borrowing under COPS to do long-term borrowing on general obligation bonds. And SGR 7 allows you to put less money up in general funds and leverage that not 1-to-1 to 3-to-1.
Yes.
Okay, so it's all methods of leveraging larger amounts of borrowing for the future. The advantage of that is that right now we're in a climate of very low interest rates, so it's probably an opportune time if you're going to borrow. And two, you have deferred maintenance to take care of, but you need to look at that maintenance very carefully, as Senator Mesley has talked about. The disadvantage is we're potentially looking at some long-term investments for the state that we have to pay back with general funds sooner or later. And we need to know what that bill is. what the advantage of it is right now as far as the economy is concerned, what the advantage is from the point of view of taking on these low interest rates, which are a real advantage, but also what the nut is on. What's it going to cost us every year for the next 10, 15, 20 years? And if you can kind of give us a big picture on that, would be very, very helpful.
I do want to stress again that I did list these other items of legislation that are out there because it seemed like a good time to bring them up because it's clearly related to capital construction budget. But please note that none of these are before you today,
mm-hmm.
and they would come forward later if you choose to address them.
But I think it is interesting for the committee to have a bigger look at the field
of
possibilities here. And given the situation that we have with general fund and looking out into the future, I don't think that any of us see that account going up quickly. I think that we need to be very prudent as we take a look at the things that are projected to be funded in 5028 and then the other mechanisms that are in play right now. Further questions or comments for Mr. Bender on his presentation? Well, let's move then to Mr. Jarvis and Mr. Simonton and Mr. McGee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before you for my first time before Ways and Means on behalf of the Oregon University system. I'd like to stress by that presence the importance of this budget as indeed...
If I could ask you to identify yourself.
Forgive me, I'm sorry. Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University system. And still the fairly new Chancellor of the system, if that's worth any marginal consideration. I'm more than happy to.
About one day.
We'll take it. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Madam Chair, members of the committee, forgive me. To stress the importance of this budget, as indeed of all elements of our budget, these are projects that have gone through a thorough review on our campuses and at the system level. Although they're supported by auxiliary services and student fees, they're integral to the communities that we build on our campuses. And our campuses are very much more than collections of buildings. They are a totality that students experience and that contribute to our ability to recruit students, to retain students, and hopefully to generate the alumni memories that we'll keep on giving as we, too, face the need to recover the debt that we're seeking to build these days. Let me introduce Bob Simonton, who is our Director of Facilities, Planning and Budget for the system, and he will take us through the presentation of our capital budget. Thank you.
Questions or comments for Mr. Jarvis? Mr. Simonton.
Thank you, Chancellor Jarvis. Chair Morgan and members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Bob Simonton. I'm Director of Capital Construction for the Oregon University System. Today I'll be talking about investments in higher education that will protect and enhance the value of our facilities. I will highlight the budget process, the four types of facility categories, the three project goals we have defined, and present each project graphically on a campus map, and finally summarize the governor's capital budget for higher education. The state has made a sizable investment in higher education facilities, with over 18 million gross square feet of building space worth over $3 billion. We are structured very much like seven cities with a complex system of buildings and roads and infrastructures that operate 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. But to modernize, repair, and expand these cities, we must complete a process which I will briefly describe. OUS is given authority to do certain things, capital construction being one of them, and every 2 years each school submits a list of capital projects to the Chancellor's office to get approval to build, remodel, or purchase something. It must be $500,000 or more to be considered. The first step is the State Board of Higher Education approval. Then the governor revises the budget to reflect his or her priorities, which may differ from our priorities. Then we present the governor's budget before this subcommittee. The legislature passes two laws, one to authorize us to spend money for the specific projects approved, and then another law authorizing us to issue bonds to finance some of the projects. The Chancellor's office plays sort of a fiduciary role in this process. We get the approvals, then we collect, disperse, and monitor the funds. Mr. Bender reviewed some of the our funding types. I'll just go through those briefly again here. Essentially, we have cash from the state, which is typically matched with the Article 11G bonds, and the debt service is paid by this, the state general fund in our OUS operating budget. We also have the Article 11F bonds, which the campuses pay the debt service after we identify some type of revenue stream to repay the bonds. We have other funds, which are gifts and grants. We have been able to use lottery bonds in the past as a match for the G bonds, where the state lottery funds pay the debt service. And then once the funding is in place, we have certain rules which govern how we can spend that money. And this slide shows the hierarchy of our capital construction rules. And I want to mention, in 1995, the Higher Education Efficiency Act was passed, giving us the authority to adopt our own contracting rules, rules that allow each campus to administer the construction process in a very cost-effective manner. And that was sort of the big picture overview of our structure. Now I want to talk a little bit about how the campuses come up with those projects that are submitted every 2 years. And we start with planning and budgeting. And most of our planning... I'm sorry.
Question. Yes. Can you talk to us about the membership of the State Board of Higher Education? Who's on that?
Madam Chair, the State Board of Higher Education, each member is appointed by the governor, and Chancellor Jarvis would probably be the better spokesperson too.
This is a little bit out of the ordinary here, but we're having this kind of small paper discussion going on back here, and this question arose.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board, members of the committee. The members of the state board are indeed appointed by the governor. There are presently 11 members of the board. 2 members are student members. 1 member is a faculty member. The board directs the activities of the system, and you'll be hearing from the board president, vice president, and chair of the strategic planning committee during tomorrow's meeting.
So who are the other members besides those 3 that you listed?
The other members are citizen members of the community appointed by the governor, confirmed by the legislature.
They're at-large citizens?
Yes.
Yeah. Are they paid?
Representative Smith?
Are they paid positions?
No, they're not.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Getting back to the how the projects, talking about the projects being submitted every 2 years, and we get back into the planning and budgeting. Talking about most of our planning rules were written in the 60s when enrollment growth was the main concern, and again, we were dealing with enrollment growth, but in an environment where we struggle to afford the cost of access and quality. The Oregon University System's internal rules address the need for long-range campus master plans. Campus master plans are the documents that say, here's where we are now, and this is the direction we want to head in the future to meet our program needs and our enrollment growth. So a list of strategic alternatives developed, which is basically a list of potential projects that will reposition our facilities to meet the goals and objectives of the campuses. However, a master plan is not a crystal ball that can predict the future, but it gives us the context needed to make informed decisions before we start pouring concrete. The last formal update of the campus master plans occurred in 2000 with this campus master plan and current life safety and maintenance studies. Each campus develops a prioritized list of capital projects that are submitted to the Chancellor's Office for review. In this budget cycle, the campus submitted their projects in May of last year, and this slide basically shows the timeline of the 2003-05 capital budget process from that point forward. You can see that the OUS board approved the budget back in July, and then the governor's recommended budget was approved back in January, and today we're seeking your recommendation of the current proposed budget.
So if I might just interject here to get the process straight in my head. In May, there were lists of projects submitted to the Chancellor's office by the campuses.
That's correct, Chairman.
And then the Chancellor's office compiled a report of those and referred that to the board. And then the board went through and figured out which ones they were going to approve. And then that was what you gave to DAS.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Okay. Before we jump into the details, I need to explain how the budget is structured. I present the governor's recommended capital budget in relation to these four facilities categories as shown on the graph. We have facilities that are classified as education in general, auxiliaries, system-wide, and finally student building fee funded projects. And this graph shows the relative proportion in the budget of each of those categories.
Could you talk to us about what these categories actually mean?
I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair. Education in general. 66% of our space is considered education in general, or ENG. And these are the facilities used for instruction and support. Historically, these facilities were state-funded with Article 11G bonds with matching general fund. But due to the economic realities facing the state, no state dollars will be used to fund projects of this type in this request. In fact, there's only been three projects in the last, I think it's seven biennia, that have been funded in this manner.
So by support, you're talking about labs and libraries and offices and those kinds of things?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. I'm curious what auxiliary is, actually.
Okay. auxiliaries represent about 27% of the total OUS space, but make up 67% of our current budget request. The projects in this category include housing, dining, athletics, parking, and they're all self-supporting, self-sustaining, and again, zero state support for these type of facilities. And next we have the student projects, which account for the remaining 7% of the OUS space at roughly 1.2 million gross square feet of space. And these projects are requested and paid for by the students. The debt service is paid directly by a student incidental fee. In the 2001 session, the fee was increased to $45 per term, which has allowed over $70 million worth of student projects to be initiated.
Can you give us some examples of what these types of projects are?
Madam Chair, certainly. Mainly upgrades to student unions, some rec and fitness centers. I think at Oregon State, the Dixon Rec Center was a $19 million project. That was probably the largest project out of the list. There's child care centers.
And this piece of the pie operates entirely outside of the venue of the legislature. The legislature has no control over the amount of these fees.
Madam Chair, the legislature does have say.
Yep. Madam Chair, for the record, Grattan Cairns, Director of Government Relations in the Oregon University System, we don't have anything that we do with a dollar that isn't under the control of the legislature. In student building fee, the fee is set by statute, approved by the legislature. It was changed in the 2001 legislative session. And prior to that, it was changed in the 1997 legislative session to set the maximum that the fee can be for student building fee debt service in a term. And that was last changed, as Bob said, in the 2001 session to allow the fee to go up to $45. The projects which are financed by that are wholly student-centered and student-used facilities, which they can recommend on each of their campuses. Those then go to their president. They go forward and go to the system, and they're rationalized there. They come here, you do approve the construction of them, and you approve the use of Article 11F1 bonds to construct them, and then those bonds are retired, debt service met, and retired by that income stream that comes from the student building fee. So you have in statute how much the fee can be. You have in this budget the projects to be funded, and you have control over it from front to back.
Question. Mr. Kearns, can you give us a little bit of history on what I'm curious about is the growth of the student building fee over time. Do you have that in your head, or is that something we can request?
Madam Chair, we can give you the history of it from its initiation. We bring that forward only with concurrence of the students themselves. In other words, we've never brought an increase in the student building fee which was opposed by the students. Because, as I say, these are wholly their projects. Student unions, very large recreation centers, of which we built a couple recently, daycare centers, and those kinds of facilities for student life. And so it's really those things that they recommend that come forward, which are then brought to you for financing, and it's only with their concurrence do we bring you an increase in the building fee. Bob and I can return and give you the history of the initiation of that fee and its increases over time.
I would be very interested in that. Mm-hmm. As a parent with three children right now in the higher education system, it is the parents that end up paying these fees. And they, given the fact that we are going to be increasing tuition, mm-hmm. I think that it would be an interesting piece of information for the members of this committee to have that will be a piece of the fees that, or the tuition big picture that those of us that pay the bills get.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to bring you that. We're not asking for an increase in that fee now and don't envision one in the near future for many of the same reasons you've just given.
Thank you. Representative Smith, did you have a question?
Oh, I just had a quick one. You don't anticipate an increase in fee this session, do you?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, we will not ask you for an increase in that fee this session, nor do we anticipate one in the near future, given the size of the capacity of the student building fee to meet debt and the backlog of student projects which had really pent up demand, which has now been cleared by that new fee level. So no, the answer would be no, we will seek none and don't anticipate one in the near future.
Thank you.
And if we do bring you one, it will be with the concurrence of the students themselves.
Chair.
Representative March.
Thank you, Senator. In not all of the universities are proposing a tuition increase. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative March, in the first year of the biennium under the program that we have now, which the presidents have reported to the chancellor, it's my understanding that in the first year there's one campus that asks no percentage increase in tuition above the level established by the surcharges, which were themselves rather substantial. Right. The governor's budget does have a placeholder for tuition for each campus, which, well, let me back up. For our purposes, we see it as a placeholder. The administration would see it as a recommendation. Did I get that right?
I think that would be fine.
Okay. In the reports made by the campuses to the chancellor, one campus says it wished to impose none of the recommended fee the governor recommended in the first biennium, but did have a substantial increase in the second year of the biennium. All others did have a recommendation to the chancellor for, I think the range in the first year was 0 to 12 coming from the campuses to the chancellor. And in the next year, I don't remember what it is, but it's in the same kind of range. I don't think anything much bigger than that.
Mr. McGee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill McGee from DAS. Just one thing I would like to add is that the governor's recommendation for tuition increases, which is a 2% for residents and 3.5% for non-resident, for all students. The first percentage of that would be funds that he's used to shift general fund costs. So there is a there's a sort of a statewide implication for at least 1% of that tuition fee.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be sort of beyond just the operating budgets for the campus.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, did that finish up your line of questioning?
That's fine.
We'll start on that in the morning.
Senator Mesery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You might have received the answer to my question while I was out a second ago. But how do we guarantee the repayment of these bonds? Is that the general fund responsibility or?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Simon, has the answer.
Madam Chair, Senator Mesery. All the bonds are backed by the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon.
So we're talking general fund here.
If we would default, that is correct.
Mr.
Chair, Bill McGee again. The Article 11 G bonds are fully backed by general fund debt service. The Article 11 F1 bonds are generally paid by a dedicated revenue stream, such as housing fees, dormitory fees. There is first and foremost a dedicated revenue source from them. It would only be if those revenue streams were insufficient to pay the debt service that it would then fall back to the general fund, and I'm not aware that's ever happened.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I'm in the water over my head here right now, so I'm going to think about this for a while.
Okay.
I've got some real serious questions about process. This budget's been developed over the last year and a half, 2 years. I follow the OSU board looking at it. I see the administrative side of government involvement through DAS, the governor's office. It's a huge budget. I don't see any request here for legislative participation in developing this. I have no idea what these projects are. It's a huge amount of money, and we're halfway through the session, and I really am over my head right now.
Halfway through the session?
I'm an optimist. Okay. So I have concerns.
Well, and I think that all of us have concerns. This is a huge piece, I think, for anyone to try to bite off, given the fiscal realities that we're facing right now. But let's continue discussing this and hopefully try to diminish the things we don't know and increase the things we do know. And with that, could you please talk to us about what system-wide means?
Okay. We were talking about the four facility categories. We have the education in general, the auxiliaries, the student building fee, then we move on to the system-wide. And this group of limitations are designed to support the ENG, the auxiliary, and the student building fee facilities. The system-wide projects address capital repair, code and safety, and modernization projects which are not large enough to receive a separate project limitation. So each of these projects are under $1 million and are focused on keeping the facilities operational by replacing worn-out parts. So this category has a mixture of funding types depending on the type of building being repaired. So with the four facility categories, the ENG, the auxiliary, student building fee, and system-wide, we have three goals that the campuses have identified that are the driving factors behind each of these projects. We've identified either one, quality facilities, or two, enrollment growth, or program needs are the main goals behind each project. And this graph shows the relationship in the capital budget of those goals. Quality facilities are certainly.
I'm looking at enrollment growth 30% on this pie chart. What I'm concerned about here is, given the fact that we're in this huge economic uncertainty pit that we're in right now, we're having to increase the cost of going to college, and what I want is to get some information on what you based your growth projections on and whether they were pre economic recession or in the economic recession, or just how relevant they are to the situation that we find ourselves in right now.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'm happy to do that, and I'm about three slides away from that. I can get into enrollment growth if that's
okay.
All right. First, we'll talk about the quality facilities portion of that chart. And those projects are geared to fix what's broken or worn out. And half of our buildings were constructed between 1960 and 1975. And now, some 30-plus years later, many of the subsystems within those buildings are failing due to age. You can see here the wave of construction that happened during the 1960 to 75 period. This huge amount of growth was in response to the baby boomers entering college. Now in 2003, we're faced with a wave of capital repair projects to keep this huge inventory of old buildings operational. A recent study estimated our backlog of capital replacement projects at about $500 million for just the education and general buildings alone. And our one-for-one match requirement for state funds has not been able to address the magnitude of the problems when weighed against educational quality and access.
Madam Chair.
Senator Mosley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you go more in depth on the needs of the deferred maintenance? We've been through 10 years of probably the strongest economy this state's ever known. And I'm wondering why this maintenance is deferred and we're trying to catch up on it this year.
Chair Morgan, Senator Miserly, I asked that same question also. It's not that we haven't asked, because we have. It's just simply that we're not enough resources when you weigh educational access and educational quality, and then the third piece, maintain the facilities. There was a choice that was made.
Madam Chair, Gretchen Cairns, for the record again. Let me expand on that. What Bob said is absolutely true as a background, but the principal reason was ballot measure 5 adopted in 1990. Between 1990 and 1999, the share of the general fund dedicated to the Department of Higher Education dropped from 12.4% to 6.9%, near about 7%. And as this wave of deferred maintenance was coming on, you've got 50% of your buildings built in a 15-year window. Throughout 25 to 40 years, deferred maintenance occurs. Each request advanced to, three governors for increase in that amount to step up, stair-step the need for deferred maintenance expenditures have been relatively flat-lined. Not because the governor, all three of them since 1990, didn't want to meet it. I mean, it was budgets which were under the throes of ballot measure 5. The funds were not appropriated. We had a relatively steady state in appropriations. So we had what I've described as a near perfect storm. Onset of an entire age class coming into a need. Demand for access with the greater demand for students to come in. At the same time, funds are being withdrawn from the university system. You end up with a backlog that is unmet. Now, the board every 2 years has faithfully requested funds, and in each biennium, no offense to the governor or any of the three governors, you were also caught in the throes during that period of how do you budget for this huge new requirement for transfer to the K-12 system. It came out of other general fund agency budgets. I mean, if you look at the history of the general fund between 1990 and today, that's why Bob said earlier, we're now in our seventh biennium of no relative increase in the amount of monies which are appropriated for deferred maintenance and thus matched to Article 11G bonds. You get that flat line against a growing need. I think he's going to show you a slide on that. Was that responsive, Senator?
I guess not a follow-up, just a comment that I'm not necessarily being critical of the higher ed, or I'm really being critical of the legislature themselves, because if you don't take care of maintenance, it's going to really catch up to you in a hard way, and we're being caught now. It's probably the worst time in the last 10 years for the revenue sources of the state of Oregon. It's just unfortunate let's face it, maintenance is not a very sexy item when you're talking about all the other needs and high tech and biotech and all those other things that we're trying to meet. But I think we should have been much more prudent, and hopefully we can be more prudent in this session to take care of this backlog.
We have a proposal for you, Senator.
Well, in a further editorial comment on that, I think that we could have the very same discussion if we were talking about the K-12 system and if we were talking about the community college system. And my feeling is that there's always going to be, no matter how much money we push into the front end of this, a dissonance about where it's going to be spent, because it's never going to be enough money. And so the places that are going to be underfunded are going to be, I think, mutually agreed on decisions.
Again, talking about our deferred maintenance, we performed that study that identified $500 million of repairs that we put on the shelf due to the lack of funding. The study also looked ahead 50 years and determined that we need to spend roughly $40 million per year, just on average, just to keep the current backlog from growing any larger than $500 million. And again, we are currently funded by the state at roughly $12 million per year, which explains why the backlog was created. The unfunded portion in red on the slide is the part that gets deferred each year. The part in gray is roughly the $12 million that we're funded through the state. So under SGR 1 and Senate Bill 240, we have initiated a constitutional amendment process to allow OUS to fund 100% of the backlog with general obligation bonds without having that one-for-one match requirement. The difficulty we face in talking about this deferred maintenance problem is that, for the most part, our campuses look pretty good on the exterior, but beauty is only skin deep. Now, this graph highlights the building systems in need of replacement. Over 70% of the $500 million backlog is related to HVAC, electrical, and plumbing, and I call these showstoppers when they fail, all of which are found inside walls or hidden in mechanical spaces. An example of a recent showstopper occurred on the PSU campus when a switch shorted and flooded a mechanical room, which serves electricity, steam, and chilled water to five other buildings in the center of campus. Bad things happen when you mix water and 13,000 volts of electricity. We lost over $300,000 worth of equipment, including transformers and motors and controls. I use this example on our website for deferred maintenance to highlight some of the problems we face, and I'll share that with you now. So this says that half of our facilities were constructed between 1960 and 1975, and that our systems are made up of 11 major subsystems in the building. And each subsystem has a lifespan, and that the subsystems that were constructed in the 60s and 70s were at the end of the life cycle of those. And our recent study estimated that the current backlog is about $500 million. So that and other information about our deferred maintenance issues can be seen at our website at www.ous.edu. And here's the distribution of the $500 million backlog between the campuses. They're roughly proportionate to the amount of education and general space that are at each campus, except for Portland State, which has a high total due to the amount of inherited buildings in its inventory that were already in poor condition. Lincoln Hall is pictured in the background as a good example of an inherited building. This building was the former Lincoln High School. It was built in 1911. And the city of Portland was going to demolish the building 1949, but instead transferred it to Portland State University. And it's now used as classroom and performing arts center. And this building probably has the highest percentage of deferred maintenance on the Portland State campus. And now we get into the enrollment growth projections. This is the current enrollment projection, and projects that are geared to enrollment growth are to add space to accommodate more students. And this graph shows past enrollment growth and projected enrollment growth up to the year 2012. And we must address enrollment growth in the campus master plan and in the capital budget, not for the near term, but also for the longer term.
Madam Chair, to get a total picture of the education needs, can you overlay the community college's projected growth on top of what you have here for the for your higher ed systems to see what the total?
Mr. Bender, you might be in a better position.
Yes, I think
that.
I probably could.
Okay. Mr. Bender. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative March?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify, back on page 16, your capital budget request, it shows enrollment growth at 30%. That's not saying the enrollment growth is 30%. It's saying that the cost of those projects are 30% of the budget.
Madam Chair, Representative March, that is correct. It's not 30% enrollment growth. That is just the part of the projects that are geared to that out of the total capital budget request.
The can you talk to us about how you project enrollment growth?
Chancellor Jarvis, help me out with that one.
Mr. Jarvis.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor. The figures that you see on this slide showing projected enrollment growth are those that we have projected if the current behaviors that our system has been able to accommodate for the last several years are continued. So these are essentially the pipeline students that are coming towards us through K-12 and through the current rates of transfer and recruitment from community colleges, independent colleges, and returnees from out of state. We'll be presenting for you in the accompanying bill tomorrow on our operating budget much more detail on where we think actual enrollment growth might be able to go. This, the projections that you see here are essentially the demand. Were we able to continue to meet the needs of Oregonians as they have been manifest, as you can see, climbing up that curve for the last several years? So that's the pipeline growth that we would have projected.
Senator Mesley, I'm willing to defer my discussion until we take this issue up tomorrow, but I think that the projections for growth are hugely pivotal to the discussions that we need to have here. And given that the field that we're playing in is changing rapidly in a short period of time, I think we need to have a very clear discussion about how your projection process is dealing with that.
Yes, Madam Chair. We'll bring that to you tomorrow.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you break that out as to out-of-state students and in-state students and also undergraduate as well as graduate studies?
We'll be happy to do that. Madam Chair, Senator, we'll be happy to do that for you.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Again, talking about enrollment growth, each campus manages growth by maximizing the amount of student stations in each of the classrooms where possible and using their facilities for longer hours. The U of O has even offered a tuition break to students to encourage off-peak use of their classroom facilities. Based on our ongoing study of instructional space utilization, the OUS institutions use their existing space very efficiently. But in some programs, there continues to be demand for more space than is available. And eventually, we come to a point where we either build more space or limit enrollment. And the third goal that was in that previous graph is program needs. And these projects are focused on altering existing space to fit the requirements of a particular program. The facilities must adapt to the current needs in order to retain and attract new students. And with that background, here is the total request before you. It's a little over $400 million for the 2003-05 biennium, and another $1 billion projected over the next two biennia. For 2003-05, the state's contribution in the form of general fund and G-bonds is about 6% of the total request. The remaining 94% is the responsibility of the campuses in the form of F-bonds and gifts and grants. Historically, the campuses have really leveraged the limited state dollars with gift funds to address their needs for quality facilities, projects that provide for enrollment growth, and to satisfy the program needs for both academic and auxiliary functions. Since 1995, the campuses have solicited more gift dollars for education and general projects than the state general fund and G-bonds combined. This graph shows the current relationship between the three project goals of quality, enrollment, growth, and program needs within the total magnitude of each campus's request. For example, we look at Oregon State. Their projects relate to quality facilities, as shown on the black bar. And Portland State tells us that their projects are mainly focused to handle enrollment growth. The system-wide projects are all quality-driven, and the University of Oregon is split between growth projects and keeping the existing facilities in shape. So I'd like to take you to each of the three campuses that have projects in this biennial's governor's requested budget. Unfortunately, this didn't translate well onto a black and white copies. So this is Oregon State University's campus map. The projects in red are education in general. The green is auxiliary, and the blue highlighted areas are student-funded projects. Now, Oregon State University's projects are focused mainly on quality facilities, so you see many renovation projects on the map. They have two education and general projects, the Instrumentation and Flow Imaging Lab, which will use $650,000 of gift funds to renovate classroom space and upgrade the building systems. And then there's the veterinary medicine project in the roughly the center of the campus, which will add $2.2 million of gift funds to provide a better integration of the existing Magruder Hall and the new small animal hospital addition. So this project will actually save operating dollars by making the program more efficient. OSU's top auxiliary project is Research Stadium expansion and the lower center part of the map at $110 million to upgrade electrical and plumbing systems and add 10,000 seats. There's also several housing and dining projects, again, mostly repairing existing structure. And there is one student building fee project, the Memorial Union renovation and repair at $5.5 million to address deferred maintenance issues.
Representative March.
Thank you. The veterinary medicine, when you said it's a small animal hospital, so it's not serving the needs of cattle and horses and things like that?
It is.
Madam Chair, Representative March, the small animal hospital addition was approved in the last session. This is another component to that project to allow them some greater efficiencies in the project. So this piece actually renovates the operating suites in the existing Magruder Hall to allow one single operating theater instead of having separate operating rooms for large animals and small animals. So you don't have to duplicate your staff of OR technicians, nurses, and doctors.
And how much was approved last time?
It was $8 million.
So that's on top of that.
Could you, for us, break down the funding sources for each of these two. I mean, student building fees is kind of a given. The auxiliary is coming out of the other funds, the other revenue category?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The auxiliaries would be Article 11F bond-funded projects. As a research stadium is using some gift funds. Go back to the list.
But here. All of the things in the education and general category are coming out of the 11F bonds?
Madam Chair, they're all gift-funded projects. 100% gift dollars for the two education and general projects shown there, the instrumentation project and the vet medicine project, $2.2 million, are both gift-funded.
Then just for my own clarification, would it be a true statement to say that all of the capital projects at OSU do not have an impact on the general fund?
Madam Chair, that's correct. All the projects I'm about to show you have no impact on state general fund or Article 11G projects. It's only the system-wide projects, which I'll get to in a minute here.
A question, Representative Smith. Didn't last session we approve a top-tier engineering facility for, or was that the education part of it, Grant?
Madam Chair, Grant and Cairns again. Yes, you did. In this budget, as in previous budgets, the amounts that have come forward from the campuses in their master plan for new education and general projects inside their campus master plan approved by the board, submitted to the governor, have been stripped out by the governor because of the concern about the general fund match to the Article 11G. In each of the last three or four biennia, projects have been produced which have had match funding. At OSU, there was a and at Eastern, there was a new use of funds, and that was lottery funds to match the general.
So you're saying,
may I follow up?
So you're saying that we're no longer going to strive to have a top-tier engineering school in Oregon?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, no, not at all. The Kelly Engineering Building broke ground, is under construction now on that campus. $20 million in Article 11G bonds, which was authorized by the last legislative session, and a $20 million gift from Mr. Kelly, an alum, from his own resources, as Mr. Bender said earlier, came in, was put in a donation account, became general funds under the Constitution for purposes of matching those bonds. So you appropriated none of your own dollars to do that. You permitted that match to take place. That is primarily how new education and general structures are built here, because the campuses have to come up with their own match because none comes forward in the governor's budget. That's one of the reasons why you'll later hear about SJR 7.
And I would presume that in the recap of future indebtedness to the general fund, that the 11G bonds that are involved in the building of that that building will be part of that report that you bring us.
Yes, and indeed, and we are already within the $25 million that is in the budget this time around for debt service and Article 11G bonds. Some of that is for these bonds that were issued last biennium for the new engineering building at OSU. But I'm getting back to the representative's question about that particular facility. That was, since that was approved last time,
so it's not on here.
Year, yeah.
But it's not finished yet.
Right. Actually, just as a technical point, whenever you approve a capital construction project, the approval exists or lasts for 6 years. So the system has 6 years to complete the project. If for whatever reason they're not able to complete it in that period of time and they still wish to continue, they have to come back and ask for a renewal of their bond.
Okay.
Senator Mesley.
I just need clarification, Madam Chair. Thank you. When you made the statement that general funds is not obligated for these construction projects, When they're completed, however, there will be general fund obligations for operations. Is that an accurate statement?
Madam Chair, Senator Messily, that is correct. There will be, in the OUS operating budget, a commitment to maintain the facilities. The instrumentation and flow imaging lab, for example, is an existing building. This is just a renovation. So you currently are paying for the maintenance of that facility.
I'm sure.
Follow up.
I'm not talking about the maintenance. I'm talking about the instructional staff. And I'm thinking maybe the veterinary building is an example of that. Once you build the building, then you have another operation budget that comes in. And that's one of the concerns. I want to get a full picture of what we're talking about. And I would assume there's other facilities that we're building, such as the engineering school. You build the building, and then you've got a tremendous budget that's going to come along and impact general fund later.
Madam Chair, Senator Messler, that is correct. And I believe the veterinary medicine, for example, the operating budget component of this school was approved by the legislature last session because we are increasing that program. It was a two-year program. It will now be a four-year program, and this is the facilities that allow us to make that switch happen from a two-year to a four-year program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Messley, to follow up a little bit on that, the instructional budget as well as operation maintenance is not entirely general fund. For some of these facilities, well, for all the facilities that are education general, you would have some of that being paid out of tuition and fee revenue. Some of it would be paid out of indirect recovery from federal or other grants. Some of it may be paid from endowed chairs as well. So it's not entirely general fund obligation. In fact, it may probably likely be less than 50% of general fund obligation.
The capital cost of these projects, of building new buildings or remodeling buildings, does that also include the furnishings and the supplies and the equipment that's needed to bring the building to an operational turnkey state?
Madam Chair, some of the projects do have furnishings included in them. Some of them do not. It's buried in the detail somewhere where the scope of the project will list if equipment and furnishings is included in the project.
So if we were to take a look at those projects that didn't have that component funded, then the funding for that component would come from the other sources of funds that you just outlined. Is that correct?
I'm sure that's correct, or gift funds.
So there's a potential other impact on the general fund depending on whether the project covers the furnishings and the equipment that's necessary.
Madam Chair, for the most part, these projects are all auxiliary projects, so they more than likely would be in the projects and funded by Article 11F bonds, which the campuses are responsible for the debt service.
I think it would be interesting for the committee to, with relevance to your project list here, to get some kind of approximation on which ones of these projects are fully funded down to the furnishings. I mean, and what I mean is the ones that are going to be ready for students to come in and do whatever the buildings are supposed to do, or alumni to come in and do whatever the buildings are supposed to do. And whether what I'm trying to do here is get at what the true general fund impact is, not just on the maintenance and staffing issues, but also on the completing these things so that they're actually in a useful state.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to look at each of the projects and identify which ones have equipment and furnishings included in the project limitations.
Thank you. Mr. Bender.
If I may just interject, I know that there's been some mention of this already, and Mr. McGee will talk about this in more detail, but just to clarify that in the projects that the governor approved, essentially, the criteria that he used to choose those projects is that except for this academic modernization item, that first item, these items should have no general fund, state general fund cost in terms of debt service and, you know, primarily in terms of operations as well, since the projects that were approved are ones that are being operated by in auxiliaries where there are other sources of funds to finance them. But, they'll be getting back to that, but that's just the basic overview of the projects that are here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
A question for Mr. Bender. When you just said that operationally these buildings are still dependent on tuition and general fund monies, I would expect some along the line.
Not necessarily. For example, something like a housing facility, they are budgeted not to use any general fund at all. That's why they are called auxiliaries, because they operate separately as almost like a business, where the costs of operating a housing service are generated entirely from the fees that are charged.
So unless there was some kind of a meltdown and the fee revenue wasn't available, then the project should be supported by other fund revenue streams.
Yes, that's the criteria for these particular projects here.
Madam Chair, that begs the question in my mind that we need to look at these projects more carefully. If 94% or some odd number is outside education, we must be looking at stadium projects, parking lots, student housing, things that are not the core business of the university but are truly auxiliary. So it goes back in my mind to looking at these projects carefully and seeing where the money is going. The general fund obligation, either as a debt service or upfront money,
right,
appears to be substantially smaller than what else is going on.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm just going to think about this.
Well, and then it kind of begs the question, too, that in the academic modernization capital repair deferred maintenance code and safety compliance line item of the projects, are all of the projects that you have within that category buildings that were generally funded when they were built?
Madam Chair, that is correct. The state portion of that line item, the general fund, the $12.5 million of general fund, the $12.5 million of Article 11G bonds, those state dollars would go to repair buildings that were originally constructed from state dollars. And typically, I mentioned earlier that our needs are about $40 million per year. So these dollars would be essentially used for emergencies, emergency repairs and replacement. And to a lesser extent, modernization. And also, it also competes with code and safety issues. So we need to be in compliance with all the current life safety codes in order to retain the occupancy permits for each of our buildings.
Thank you. Please proceed. I think that we've derailed you pretty well in your presentation.
So again, looking at this graph, the projects that are highlighted in red are the education in general. Typically, they're the state-funded projects, but in this budget request, we are not asking for any state commitments to renovate or construct these buildings. These were all would be gift-funded projects. Moving on to Portland State University, enrollment growth is clearly the overall focus here. However, no education in general projects have been recommended. The top auxiliary project is a new 6,000-seat athletic arena for $25 million to replace the current 1,200-seat gymnasium. Now, this is an enrollment growth issue, and the site is yet to be determined. The remaining auxiliary projects focus on housing. We have two new projects and one renovation project, and they're highlighted in green. Portland State's number one student building fee project is a continuation of the improvements to their Smith Memorial Union at $7 million. The students also approved a remodel of the existing child care center and a renovation of their rec and fitness center. Okay. And move on to the University of Oregon. On this campus, it's a pretty even mixture. of projects between enrollment growth and maintaining the existing facilities. The U of O has four education and general projects. The first is the heart of campus. It's not a building. It's essentially a landscaping project to revitalize a major intersection in the center core of campus. And all these will be gift-funded projects. The second is a Museum of Natural History addition, which adds needed exhibit and classroom space. The third ENG project is the final phase of Allen Hall, which completes the renovation for the School of Journalism and Communication. And the fourth is the Alumni Center, which is a new welcome center to foster alumni relations and development programs. And then we move on to the auxiliary projects, which are a mixture of new and renovated housing and one parking garage on the left side of the campus. The UO has one student building fee project, the University Health and Counseling Center expansion, which proposes to renovate and expand a 1960s-era building into a modern healthcare facility. Okay, so those were the campus projects.
Question?
Yes.
Representative Smith. We just looked at three universities. We have seven. What's going on with the other universities?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the each campus did propose buildings, but the smaller school projects did not survive the governor's recommended budget, except for one project at Southern, which was a gift-funded project, which was off-campus for their
follow-up. Well, are the needs as great for other universities? I know their universities are smaller. Are they as aged as well as far as deferred maintenance or not? Can you enlighten me on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, their needs are ever as important as the larger universities. Unfortunately, they don't have possibly the resources to year after year solicit the large donations that the larger schools have become accustomed to doing to bring their projects forward. And I should add that last session that each of the schools had quite a few projects approved, which are currently under construction. So possibly some of the demand was met last session.
Madam Chair, if I could have a maybe an overview of the most recent projects on the universities, so that I know that things are being treated on an equal and justifiable basis. I mean, just looking at this, I see three universities asking in the governor's budget for the bulk of the renovation, and I want to know what's going on at the other universities, the age of their projects and so forth, so I can have a broader look at the whole system.
So perhaps three bienniums worth of construction projects?
Yeah, I think that would be, on all seven, you know, I think that would be useful. So, you know, we need to get a big picture here of what's happening in our system. And I don't think we did that last session, did we, Granton? Looked at it in that regard. I think we just did piecemeal stuff.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, no, we gave you a pretty detailed overview, a historical view of what had occurred and what was in the pipeline. There was an extraordinary amount of pent-up demand for ENG buildings, which were not recognized in the governor's budget, which the legislature in its own motion, after making inquiry and the legislature, this committee itself, asked for a presentation of those. A number of them were funded. Some are ongoing now on those campuses. The library at Southern is going forward. The science complex at Eastern has been completed. Ribbon cutting is coming presently. So there's been a number of those projects that were cleared. But each of the campuses, as Mr. Simonton said, did have projects which did not make the governor's budget, as did any the rest of the campuses, for Article 11G projects, of which those campuses did have some. And we will happy, and I think we can very easily construct a 3 or 4 biennial look. What was authorized, what's constructed, what is still in the planning and gift development phase by each campus, and you can have an overview.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful if we could get that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I don't know if I'm getting my arms around this or not, but I think I may be actually starting to get there. I'm kind of a dunderhead sometimes. The last biennium looks like you spent about $465 million in improvements and renovations. This time you're going for another $40 million. We're approaching $1 billion in 4 years. There should be some catching up occurring somewhere along the line. And I'm starting to understand that there are some revenue streams here, but I'm going to follow up with Representative Smith. I'd like to see an overall picture here. And it really begs the question why the legislature was not involved in this much earlier in the process, 6 months or a year ago. Mm-hmm. Committee or task force should have been working with you so we could bring it forward with more understanding. Now, these are huge projects, lots of money involved. While the obvious discussion fee that F1 bonds or 11 F bonds are not really part of general revenue, in fact, there is a relationship. It affects student tuition, which we help fund, and it affects a lot of other issues at the campuses we help fund, and that is our responsibility, I believe, to oversee this. And I would like, Madam Chair, with your permission, to just for my own logic, to drill down on one particular project so I can understand better how the rest of the projects work. And the project I've chosen is the University Health and Counseling Center expansion at the University of Oregon campus. I'm going to do that because I have some knowledge in that area. I'd like to know how many students are seen and treated there each day. I'd like to know the number of staff you have there, how many physicians, nurse practitioners, and PAs you have, and what they're each paid. I'd like to know what their daily census is for seeing patients. I'd like to know why $10 million is being used for an expansion of a project like that. I've built a lot of medical buildings. I've headed up groups of 300 physicians. We don't build buildings like, unless you've got a huge number of people there and it's a major expansion, I'd like to see where that money's going, how you're spending the money, what's going on. It'll be sort of educational for me. And if that looks comfortable, I would feel a lot more comfortable about the rest of these projects. But that's the kind of drilling down, I think, that maybe would have helped us all if it had been occurring over a longer period of time and not just suddenly here, and for me at least, suddenly here in committee. Does that make sense, ma'am? Or am I off base here on this?
No, I think that would be instructive for the members of this committee to get a closer look at how one of these projects did make the cut list.
Okay.
Excuse me, and what the rationale was for the decision that was made to put it on this part of the list rather than the part that ended up in the file folder that's still back on the desk. And this kind of relates to the issue that I have with enrollment growth, because I know that over the last three biennia, the system has been building at a huge pace, and there have been immense capital construction projects going on within the system. And given that all of it isn't directly related to student education, there are research facilities and different things like that, that would be outside of the enrollment growth issue, but a great deal of it is related to providing classroom space and living space and services to students. And so I think that as we are, appearing to be continuing down the road here, where we have a fairly hefty amount of financial energy being directed into capital construction projects, that we really do need to take a look at the basis that we're using to project growth of people that are going to be filling these buildings up. And I just have a huge level of concern that given increases in tuition, given decreases in our ability to give scholarships and awards to students, and given the general economy and parents' ability to pick up the piece that falls in our venue, what impact that is going to have on enrollment growth.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to provide additional information and involve the legislature earlier into the process. I do want to add that the majority of these projects, well, frankly, all the projects, require some sort of revenue stream before we authorize the construction of those projects. We're simply asking for the the limitation or the ability to construct these projects at some point in the future within that six-year window that we're authorized to construct these projects. So if, let's say, the enrollments would drop off, that would be a clue to us that, well, maybe we shouldn't build Project A because the revenue streams wouldn't be there. And that's a decision we can make in the future based on the actual enrollment growths. But if the enrollments do happen as we projected, and we've been fairly successful in projecting those enrollments, then we would have the ability to construct buildings to meet the growing demand.
The other question I have is, given the large area that you have that's unfunded in terms of deferred maintenance and repair and that area of your budgeting, and given the inability of the general fund to really respond in this area and the uncertainty that we have with what we expect to receive and the fact that we're still in a declining revenue situation and haven't found the bottom of whatever it is that we're in right now, I am curious about why there isn't more of the other revenues being directed into deferred maintenance than there is. Why there's a choice to put those funds into capital construction projects?
Madam Chair, typically the repair of the state buildings has been the responsibility of the state, and we've
But clearly that is not what's happening.
So then the next piece, we've been allowed to use gift funds to match the Article 11G bonds in order to construct new buildings. But that model doesn't really work well when we're trying to replace sewer lines. It's difficult to get plaques or naming rights for donors willing to donate for sewer lines and electrical systems.
This coat of paint.
We could put the plaque on each of the toilets or something, but it's, you can imagine the difficulty we have in coming up with half of those dollars in gifts in order to match the G bonds.
Well, surely, though, you must be having a discussion internally that given our reticence to commit general fund in the future for anything at this point in time, you've got to be having some discussions about how you're going to deal with this deferred maintenance issue, given that general fund is probably not on the horizon here.
Madam Chair, we've had some limited success in using gift funds and with the Department of Energy and using energy tax credits to replace components that have an energy nature to them, fan units and so forth, and motors, but it doesn't address the big picture of needs. It's we have more than we have building exteriors and quite a large, I look back to our the graph that detailed all the components. There's 11 major subsystems that in each building that can wear out. It's not all items that are readily gift fundable. So we need to find some other mechanism to fund those projects. And our first attempt was for the last seven biennia to ask through the capital budget process. That didn't work. So now we're going for.
I would expect that after 14 years of getting the same answer that.
So the next step is we try for a constitutional amendment to allow us to use 100% of bond funds to replace all these worn-out pieces. And that's the SB 240 and SJR 1 that's currently in the pipeline. So if that fails, then the next step is probably some sort of tuition would be needed to fund these backlogs, mm-hmm. because we're getting to a point where the buildings are simply going to fail. We can't keep postponing it any longer. We had that window of opportunity the last seven biennia. Hey, we're having a problem, and you can pay us now or pay us later. Well, today's later.
And we have no money.
And we have no money.
Madam Chair, Grattan Cairns again for the record. And this is the discussion which we've had internally for some time. And the reason why we've come forward with that bond measure, which you'll see in committee, I hope it is referred to your subcommittee, and we can take it up after operating budgets are closed. We recognize that the debt service from those bonds will be attributed to our budget. We understand that we have $21.9 million in debt service, which is attributed to our budget right now in Article 11G bonds, debt service. That would be true for all $500 million of this. We've constructed what we think is a fairly conservative package, which we will present to you. But we believe that the future, that the present is not the future. There will be change. And that the debt service for that $500 million in deferred maintenance bonds will peak, if they're sold in $50 million increments over 10 years, in the 2017-2019 biennium. We believe that the size of the general fund will be greater. We believe that the budget of the university system will be larger. Certainly the population of Oregon will be greater, and that as a percentage of our operating budget, while larger, will not be particularly extreme. Right now, I think Mr. Simons can tell you what our entire general fund budget is represented by debt service. I believe it's under 3%.
Less than 3%.
And the national average among university systems is something approximately twice that, around 6. We've been very conservative.
I think one could presume fairly accurately, too, that this is a rolling issue and that there is no end in sight to deferred maintenance, and that the more buildings you build, the more deferred maintenance that you have out in time.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. And as you'll see in this budget, 94% of the bonds which are being sold and the deferred maintenance for the facilities that are going to be constructed is almost entirely embedded in the budgets of the housing units, the dining halls, the memorial unions, the recreation centers, health centers, et cetera. And most, if not all of that, is absorbed in those budgets, which are segregated from the general fund and the education and general budget of the campus. And only about 6 or 7% of the budget that you have in front of you in 5028 is actually represented in construction, which will require at some point the campus's education and general budget to maintain it, staff it, et cetera. Not all of which, as Mr. McGee pointed out, comes from appropriations that you will make. You make only half of the contribution to our education and our instruction budget anyway, half of the rest of it coming from tuition, indirect cost recovery, other campus income, royalties, rents, and then the other thing that the campus has to use. So in this budget, a very small amount of future deferred maintenance is going to be required from the projects you're approving in this budget when you do. The vast majority, 90, better than 9 out of $10, will be supported by those auxiliary budgets. And they are contained within those budgets, and they have to be self-supporting and may not leak that out into the campus general fund. So in this budget, you have very little ongoing. We do agree, however, when you see Senate Joint Resolution 1, Senate Bill 240, when it does come to your committee, there will be an obligation. We will show you a debt schedule. It will be large, and it represents the inability to meet those deferred maintenance needs as they occurred year by year by year. And it did take, even though we are ahead in higher education, it did take us a while to get figured out that there wasn't going to be any increase in general fund to appropriate for those. We have to ask for it in the catch-up package, and that's a function of the process we've been involved in.
Representative March.
This might be more for DAS or LFO, and in particular when we see the next, when we see SJR 1 and 240, but it also applies to this budget. What is, and that's, I'm coming from the Trade and Economic Development Committee on this, what is the sort of multiplier effect, the stimulus effect of general fund spending on capital projects, and what does it tend to generate in revenue back to the state through the increase in economic activity. Is there any kind of standard multiplier or something like that where we'd get kind of a picture back?
Well, we've seen in various cases people who are supporting capital projects will present them as having these types of multiplier effects, and presumably much of this may be true. We tend not to look at that, though, because if you're looking at general fund, for example, if it's going to a capital project or if it's going to something else, it's not as if the funding wouldn't have been spent. You know, when you're looking at where to spend the funds, you really have to look at what you're going to be, what the goal is that those funds are designed to address, what the problem is, and see if that makes the best use of those funds. Now, if we have a situation where you're bonding, there will be more expenditures, state expenditures, than there would be otherwise, because this isn't a situation where you have to balance the budget at a particular point in the particular biennium where we are. And presumably, because there would be more state expenditures, that could have stimulative effects on the economy. But we tend to shy away against trying to look at these multiplier effects because, again, whenever there is a particular, if we were to bond for this, if we're going to bond so many hundred million dollars, instead of saying, well, if we spend it on this project, we'll be hiring so many construction workers and it'll have this effect, that may not be the most helpful way for the legislature to look at that issue, because the question is, should we use it for this project? You know, if you made the decision to bond, then you have to decide what to use the bond funds for. So it's a more complicated process, I think, than just trying to do some type of multiplier.
Now, in this case, we're looking at 12.5 billion out of 400 general fund. So the bulk of this is not general fund. Is that correct?
Correct. This capital construction budget has very little general fund and general fund supported debt in it. If we compare this budget, for example, to the budget for the 2001-03 biennium, in this biennium, 2001-03, the legislature approved about $115 million in state-supported bonds. So these are bonds that the state is paying the interest on. And again, these types of projects are typically the academic types of projects. We don't issue these types of bonds for things such as housing, dormitories, parking structures, or anything like that. These are the academic facilities, libraries, classrooms, labs, academic offices, those types of things. In this budget, the number is down from 115 million to 12 million. So you can see this is a major difference from the biennium, the 2001-03 biennium. Instead, the things that are left in this budget are only the projects that have some other type of funding source available to them, either gifts or these Article 11F1 bonds. And if you look at the $400 million total, more than a fourth of that is in one project, the Research Stadium expansion. That's over $110 million right there. So, it's important to see when you look at totals how this budget is different from what has been done in the past, that sort of thing. And I know Representative Smith had asked for some information from prior biennia, and I'll work with the department to get that to you.
If I might step in here in the interest of time, we have 10 minutes left, and so I'm wondering if there is anything in the last few pages of your presentation that we need to go over that we haven't already covered, because I would like to give Mr. McGee time to do the DAS presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll take you through my presentation, a lot of which you've heard, but trying to highlight some of the reasons the governor made the choices he did to make this recommendation to you. As we've talked about, the budget for capital construction for OUS is $12.5 million general fund. The original budget is $342.7 million other funds. That's about 4% general fund. The rest is other funds. Page 4 of my presentation, again, shows you where the different revenue sources that support that amount are, 4% from the general fund, 4% from Article 11G bonds, which the debt service will be paid beginning in 2005-07 biennium with general fund. 60% is Article 11F bonds, which are required to have their own source of revenue for debt service, such as housing fees, dining fees, parking fees, whatever. And 32% are other revenues from gifts, grants, donations, other different sources of revenue. Page 5, the Steve indicated we do have a significant decrease from the 2001-03 budget, 23% decrease. No changes approved through the five special sessions, but to highlight the governor's rationale, there are, first, as you've heard, 25 different projects at four campuses, the system-wide deferred maintenance and academic modernization, student building fee projects, and project reserves. The rationale in building the budget was, first, that there would be no general fund or Article 11G-funded projects beyond the level directed by the legislature in a budget note for the deferred maintenance and academic modernization. Again, that's the $12.5 million general fund and the $12.5 million of Article 11G bonds. The governor's budget also required that there be no Article 11F bonds that would obligate department or campus operating budgets for debt service. That would be allowed would be Article 11F bond projects that had a dedicated revenue stream for debt service. Again, housing, dining, parking, gifts, grants, donations, student building fees. So essentially projects that are truly self-supporting, self-liquidating. And as a result, I think in reference to Representative Smith's question, with that set of criteria, the smaller campuses generally fell out because they didn't have projects that had those revenue sources that were self-supporting. Their projects were primarily ones that would have required general fund match and or general fund debt service to pay them off. So with that set of criteria, that's where you see only a few campuses coming forward that could generate those. Again, what are we doing with deferred maintenance? Again, I think you've heard discussion of Senate Bill 240 and Senate Joint Resolution 1, that it would propose a constitutional amendment that would authorize $500 million in bonds for deferred maintenance on Education General Services buildings. The plans the department has are beginning in January 2005. They would sell $50 million in bonds per year for a 10-year period. The authority to issue those bonds would sunset at the end of the 10-year period. If approved by the voters, OUS would request expenditure limitation from the Emergency Board in 2004 for projects. There is no limitation for these deferred maintenance bonds in the governor's budget at this time. We do need a vote from the public to authorize that. Estimates based on this scenario would be that the general fund debt service, when it began in 2005-07, would start at about $10.3 million on the first $50 million of bonds. When fully phased in the 2015-17 biennium, the debt service is estimated at $76 million. Of course, as Grattan indicated, that theoretically is a much larger state general fund, a much larger operating budget for the department, additional.
I certainly hope so.
Well, the value of money, of course, as you know, Representative, changes also over time. So not as big a number now as it would be a much larger number now that would be in 2015-2017.
Well, I once worked for a very wise gentleman who helped me understand lumber markets, and he said, be very careful because what goes up also comes down.
As we're seeing these days, I think, yes. Finally, under this scenario, we'd fully pay off this $500 million bonds in the 2043-45 biennium, probably one you haven't heard referred to before.
Jeez.
The next several pages is taking through how the governor's budget was developed. Again, the 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget had $12.1 million general fund and $387 million in other funds. There were several emergency board actions through April 2002. There was one project at Oregon State University for the initial phase of the College of Veterinary Medicine, expansion of $3.8 million in general fund and $4.2 million in other funds. Article 11 G bonds primarily, but not exclusively. Portland State University had a purchase of a property for $3.5 million other funds. The engineering building at Oregon State University, integrated services building, Eastern Oregon University, and a Native American Center at Portland State University. Those are the emergency board projects that you saw. Base budget adjustment here was simply the elimination of the expenditure limitation for projects that were approved, $3.8 million in general fund and $433.2 million in other funds. the essential package, there was an inflation amount on the 12.5 general fund, 12.5 Article 11 G bonds that were specified for the legislature to be ongoing for deferred maintenance and academic modernization. That's the inflation here. We have package 180. It's for new projects, $330 million, all other funds, as we talked about, for the 25 projects at the four campuses and the system-wide deferred maintenance, student building fees, and project reserves. And finally, we have some adjustments to the budget. They have been included in the numbers you've seen from Mr. Bender from the department. Since the budget was published, the governor has recommended increasing the system-wide deferred maintenance projects by $20 million, other funds. That's $20 million from Article 11F bonds and $10 million in other revenues. Those would be entirely supported by, if the F bonds, rather, would be paid for projects that do have revenue sources to support them. If there was an emergency that came up that required use of operating budgets for debt service, the university has indicated they would inform legislative, fiscal, and budget management in advance. In addition, the budget for the Portland State University Helen Gordon Child Care Rehabilitation Project is increased by $1 million to other funds. There are some historic property requirements that need to be met there that came up since the governor's budget was put together. As Mr. Simonton indicated, the veterinary medicine school expansion, another $2.2 million to generate some efficiencies in how that the expanded facility will work. And adding a line for system-wide small capital projects, just various small items across the campuses, $12 million, which is $6 million from Article 11F bonds and $6 million from other revenues. With those adjustments, we get to about $40.4 million, which is the budget, the number you've seen from budgeted fiscal and from the system.
Questions or comments for Mr. McGee? You're getting off very easily. Thank you. And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5028. Are there any last-minute housekeeping issues you need to know before we show up again tomorrow morning?
No, Madam Chair.
I'll close this hearing, and we will reconvene again tomorrow morning at 8:30.